Hey, Eric Toe, good evening. Thanks for being here and braving the rain, which I think is known as winter in California. That's what I checked.
Rain is kind of funny.
Right. On the East Coast, that's like rain, oh.
Exactly.
Springtime. Look how nice it was today. There wasn't sleet and hail. And,
that's right.
So I feel like every series should start with a good rant.
Good rant.
Good rant.
There's something I want to rant about before we actually start the learning, and that is a joke I recently heard of someone at a specific kind of synagogue who decided that they were going to play a drinking game and take a shot every time the rabbi said the words Tikkun Olam.
Tikkun Olam.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I knew that would resonate in a specific like sphere.
I worked at the summer camps, yeah.
Okay. So I just want to start with a rant, and then we'll go into the topic at hand, which is, this is a series on interpersonal mitzvot, and we're going to start with our first class on the word chesed, on kindness. And I just want to kind of root this conversation on using words in their original context and being aware when you change the context. And tikkun olam, in its original form, it comes in the book of Isaiah. So it's this word that's thrown around by many, a rabbi and everyone else, I think, as this, you know, the main Jewish edict in life. Do you want him?
For some reason, I don't know.
Here's mine. Okay, and
if I need it,
I'll tell you. So it's that kind of catch-all phrase, like, my Judaism taught me. You can hear, like, every single person interviewed on, like, I don't know, a solidarity mission to Israel. Like, my Judaism taught me the value of tikkun olam, and that's what it means to me to live as a Jew in the world, which is great and beautiful. But tikkun olam, as it was originally stated, was in a prophecy in the book of Isaiah, l'takan olam b'malchut Shaddai, to fix the world in the kingship of God. It was really about spreading ethical monotheism to the world, and how in the Messianic era, God's kingdom would be recognized by all. So that's the original context. Then it was the idea of tikkun was adopted by the Kabbalists, primarily the Arizal in the 1500s. Rabbi Isaac Luria, who took a lot of earlier Kabbalistic material, and mostly in the Zohar and the Bahir, in books like the Sefer Yetzirah, and created his own kind of form of Kabbalah that in academic circles is referred to as Lurianic mysticism. And for the Ari, tikkun olam meant that there were mystical intentions and meditations that we could take, specifically about different letter combinations of names of God. And when you would meditate on those letter combinations, you would basically be uplifting the sparks that had fallen in the time of creation to the lowest parts of the world, and you'd be raising those sparks back up to their root, to Hashem, in the highest realms. And this was specifically what he called Shpirat HaKelim, the breaking of the vessels, that when God tried to create the world, he tried to fill these vessels with light. The vessels cannot hold God's divine light in them. The vessels shattered. The physical or more physical material of the vessels, the shards, fell to the lowest parts of creation, and attached to each shard is a nitzot, is a spark of divine light. And every time there would be a mystical mystical combination of different letters, and then later the Hasidim said every time there's a mitzvah done with this kavana, with this intent, you could bring a spark of divine light, reunite it with the creator in the upper worlds, and that's what the Kabbalists call tikkun olam, fixing the world. So of course, included in that is every mitzvah, such as doing nice things for other people, right? But to say that tikkun olam is only about social action or justice, I think is a misconstruing of the term as it was meant to be used by the Kabbalists, and certainly by Yeshayahu Isaiah when he shared that prophecy 2,500 years ago. So that's my rant.
Doing good is still doing good.
Doing good is still doing good, and doing good under any name is still a good thing.
Yeah.
So yes, I do recognize that, but I kind of purposely avoided using that word in the way I titled the series. Maybe that's why there are fewer people this time than there were last. Who knows? But in any case, I, I want to use kind of the original terms that are used within Chazal, within our tradition. And when we talk about the general idea of kindness, the word that's used is chesed, or gemilut chesedim, bestowing kindness, or gemilut, ligmol is to like give upon another, to bestow upon another kindness. So that's what I wanted to frame as a four-part series. The next three classes will be about specific examples of mitzvot that we do for others. But today I wanted to kind of talk about the broad category of chesed, what I think in some circles is reconstructed as tikkun olam, but the idea of doing good for another. What are the parameters? Where does it come from? What are the parameters of it? How does it connect us to God in our tradition? And what happens when there are conflicts between doing chesed and something else? So when we get to part two of the class, like part one, I think, is just setting up the idea of chesed in our tradition, understanding where it originates from, what its value was relative to other mitzvot in like a big picture perspective. And then when we get past that to part two, we'll talk about what happens when doing good for others requires you to spend money, right? What are you obligated to give up of your own finances to do a mitzvah for other someone else? What if it conflicts with other mitzvot, right? Specifically, we'll see that there was a major difficulty. What about Torah study versus chesed, versus doing kindness for others? We'll see that both of these mitzvot are framed in very, very broad ways by our tradition. So, well, how do I make sense of the two? How do I, when the two are in conflict, which one comes first? And then, are you equally obligated to do chesed for every person equally? It's a complicated way to say that. Are there priorities in who you should do chesed for? Right. So those are some of the conflicts that I wanted to deal with within chesed. But first, it's worth us just starting with the principle of kindness, chesed being the foundation of the universe, which I think is very, very clear in many traditions or many parts and sources within our tradition. So let's start with source one. This is the Mishnah Pirkei Avot. It's the second Mishnah in the Ethics of Our Fathers. This was offered by Shimon HaTzadik, who is one of the remnants of Anshei Knesset Gedola, men of the Great Assembly. So historically, we're rooting ourselves in the end of the Second Temple period, right on the cusp between the students of Ezra HaSofer, who brought back the diaspora from Babylon, built the Second Temple, established many of the important mitzvot we know, like Torah reading during the week. The three times a week Torah reading was a mitzvah of Ezra. The daily Amidah, the 18 and later 19 brachot, was established by Ezra and his students, the Anshei Knesset Gedola. And at the very end of that movement, right before the Mishnaic movement, you have this bridge, rabbi who is Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon the Righteous. And he said that the world stands, right, Al Shlosha Dvarim HaOlam Omed. This is probably, for some of us, not the first time we're seeing this Mishnah, that the world stands on three things: Al HaTorah, Val HaAvodah, Val Gemilut Chasadim, right, on Torah, presumably Torah study. Avoda means work, worship. So it's unclear, probably when this was originally taught, it meant worship in the temple, it meant sacrifices in the temple. Later, we understand this as just prayer, right? It's been reinterpreted. And then the third is Gemilut Chasadim, is acts of kindness. So the way I love this Mishnah, because I think of it, I imagine to myself that the rabbis were thinking about how many legs a table could stand on, right? And it's hard for a table to stand on, certainly not possible for a table to stand on one leg, unless it's a really wide bottom. But unless if you have really great yoga balance, hard to stand on one leg. Two legs, also difficult. The way I think of it, well, I guess, yeah, hopefully not so difficult. But three legs, at least when I think of a table, like that's the minimum to have stability, right, for the world to stand. Kirsten, do you disagree?
Well, first of all, there are tables with a central pedestal, and they're very stable.
So I guess we'd have...
Except that then the foot flares out.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't.
It what?
It does or it doesn't.
It can't not.
Unless if it's like...
It has some kind of
you can't just have
a post.
Well, it depends, I guess, on the relationship of the size of the post and the size of the table.
I think that's what Rabbi said. If you have a tree trunk with a table on top of that, then it's okay.
Yeah. So let's imagine we're talking about skinny posts.
Like this.
I guess... Yeah. Right. Yeah. I guess if we wanted to be really technical, we could do a historical study of tables in the Second Temple period and what those legs used to look like. But for now, let's just go with the idea. I'm thinking about the idea of Torah study and how it's... just to give you an example, there was a famous rabbi 400 years ago, Chaim of Volozhin, he was a student of the Vilna Gaon, and he wrote an important book of Jewish philosophy where he said that if there were a moment in which there was no Torah study in the world would cease to exist. So kind of based on this, like the world literally stands on these things, and if these things did not exist in the world would cease to be. Which got me thinking, and I was reading the book that I was basing myself on, I left in my office apparently, but it's a book by Rabbi Daniel Feldman. If you're interested in the things we're learning here, I recommend his book, and I'll get you the name of it after. He presented the question, well, this Mishnah makes a lot of sense, but only from the giving of the Torah on. Right? If the world really requires three pillars to stand, and one of them is Torah, and the other is the worship of the temple, one second, we know that there were 20-something, what we're going to see later, 26 generations, according to the Torah, before the Torah was given. So what did the world stand on then? I think it's a great question. Right, what could the world stand on when there was no Torah? And I think the altar of Slobodka, who was a famous Musar stage about 200 years ago, he said that before there was Torah and before there was worship in the temple, the world actually stood on one pillar. This is to Kirsten's point. A one-pillar table, one-foot table, big pillar, right? It stood on chesed alone. The world stood on chesed alone. And when you think of that, it actually starts to permeate the way that the entire Torah could be viewed. One of the first things God does in the world after creating it, and we'll get to what creation is itself in a little bit, the first action that we know that God takes in the world after putting it into existence is clothing the naked, which in our tradition is viewed as one of the primary forms of chesed, of kindness. God clothes Adam and Eve once they complain that they're naked. And what's the last thing God does in the Torah? God buries the dead. Right? God buries Moses at the very end of the Torah. So the Torah is bookmarked by two acts of divine kindness towards human beings. The entire Torah could be kind of understood under that rubric of kindness, which I thought was a beautiful, beautiful idea. Yeah, Allison.
Quick question. I know that in Pirkei Avot there are other rabbis that say other things instead of these three. Do you happen to know them off the top of your head?
No, and I think they might be in Tanit Ve Eliyahu. They're parallel texts
right.
To Pirkei Avot.
Oh, actually, so it's not in Pirkei Avot.
There might be one more in Pirkei Avot, and then there are others in other parallel texts. Just a fascinating, this is a total tangent. There is an academic theory offered by Rav David Tzvi Hoffman. I was just listening to a class about this, that Pirkei Avot that we have was actually not the first Pirkei Avot, because there are other versions of texts floating around there. Tanit Zvei Eliyahu is one of them. Avot D'Rabbi Natan, Avot D'Rabbi Eliezer. You have other things that I always had heard were commentaries on Pirkei Avot, but what Rabbi David Tzvi Hoffman, who was one of the Rosh Yeshiva, he was a student of Rabbi Samson Felhirsch in the school of kind of German modern orthodoxy, he pointed out that there was likely a primary Avot that was then later divided out into different books, but they all have some similar features to them. So anyways, for another time. This Mishnah is in the original Avot, according to this theory. I'll just share, you can read source 2 on your own for another time, but this is one of my favorite ideas. My father-in-law has taught this here at Beth Jacob, and I have also, from Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda of Berlin, another German rabbi, who I think he was born in Germany, The Netziv, he's often known as his acronym or the name of his commentary on the Torah, Amit Davar. In his commentary on the Torah, the introduction to Genesis, he asks the question that throughout Midrashic literature, Bereishit is known as Sefer HaYashar, the book of the righteous or the book of the straight. And he asks, why is it called Sefer HaYashar? Why does it get this name? So he points out that the Avot, the forefathers, throughout different sources, are referred to as the Yesharim, the straight ones. And he says that the lesson we learn from this is that this is the lesson of Derech Eretz Kadmah LaTorah, that the way of the world being a mensch, right, be acting kindly, which is, from his perspective, you need Genesis to teach you the lessons of how to treat each other, and the stories of the ups and downs of the Avot teach you these lessons. They have to come before Exodus, right, before the story of the Jewish people. You have to learn the story of how to be a good human being. And so all of Bereishit for the Netziv is basically that, is teaching you different versions of that lesson of how to be a yashar, how to be a straight and honest person, how to do good, treat others kindly, how to be an Abraham and a Sarah, the people who opened up their tent and welcomed in strangers. You need to learn Derech Eretz, the way of the land, the way of the world, before you can get to Torah. Right? It kind of reflects Rashi's opening comment on the Torah. Rashi basically says that the Torah should have started in last week's Parsha. Because
when the Jews started.
That's when the Jews started. He says it's specifically because it's the first commandment, the first mitzvah given to the Jewish people is in last week's Parsha of Chodesh HaZelechem. It should be the first month for you.
Yeah.
So the counting of Rosh Chodesh. He says, like, why do you have everything else? And so Rashi has this whole theory about how it's to show that the Jews have a connection to Eretz Yisrael, to the land of Israel, which I believe that is something that Bereishit teaches us. It seems a little superfluous. Like, we learn later that God gives us the land of Israel at the end of Devarim. So I think for me, the Netziv is a much more satisfying answer for why we need Bereishit, why we need Genesis. Before you can actually learn the particularities of what it means to follow the mitzvot as a Jew, you first need to know just how to be a mensch, how to be a yashar in the world. And he goes on to say, actually, that the Netziv says specifically that the reason that the temple was destroyed, right, the second temple is Sinat Chinam. The first temple was Sinat Chinam, was baseless hatred. The second temple is more of a debate, but it's pretty clear that during the second temple period, there were lots of mitzvahs happening, right? There was still worship in the temple, in the Beit HaMikdash. People were bringing all their korbanot, their offerings, and he basically says that we were treating each other like pretty terribly, and that was reason enough to destroy the temple, which made me think that if you go back to that idea that before we had a three-pillared system, right, before the Torah was given, what did the world stand on? And the altar of Tzedakah said, it stood on Chesed. That explains the flood, right? Because what's the justification that the Torah gives for God bringing the flood on the world?
People were bad.
Right. Chamas. The language, something like the land filled with Chamas. And Chamas is often translated as robbery, right? When we couldn't learn how to treat each other properly with chesed, with kindness, or at least with some baseline of equity, right? God literally destroyed the world. And I think that's like a beautiful kind of underlying idea to this, that before there was Torah and before there was Avodah, the entire world stood on kindness. The whole Torah is based on that idea. To bring this a little bit further, we'll see how the Rambam later defines chesed. So let me pause and ask you the question, and then we'll get to it. What does chesed really mean? It's a valid question. So, you know, let's actually jump ahead, because I think it's a worthwhile question on its own. The bottom of the second page is Maimonides and the Guide of the Perplexed in Morne Vuchim. So this is the Rambam's Book of Philosophy.
I think it includes generosity.
Okay, great. Generosity. We're going to see some fancy English. Whenever I quote the Guide of the Perplexed, Don, you'll tell us if it's an accurate synonym. When I bring Guide of the Perplexed sources, I don't bring Hebrew because it was written in Arabic, and so there is a very good Hebrew translation from hundreds and hundreds of years ago, but I don't see the purpose in translating from Hebrew something that was not originally written in Hebrew. So we'll read an English translation. Allison, do you want to start us off with the source?
Number 10.
Yeah.
Okay. We've already explained in the commentary on Avot that the meaning of chesed is excess in whatever matter excess is practiced. In most cases, however, it is applied to excess in beneficence. Now, it is known that beneficence includes two notions, one of them consisting in the exercise of beneficence towards one who has no right at all to claim this from you, and the other consisting in the exercise of beneficence toward one who deserves it, but in a greater measure than he deserves it. In
so
most
just pausing here. So chesed as a word, as a term, means more than, is kind of how he's defining it. And what does it, practically speaking, mean? It's giving someone something more than what they had before. There's two forms. There's either someone deserves A, but you give them A plus B, or someone deserves nothing at all, but you choose to give them A. So two forms of that. Yeah, keep going.
In most cases, the prophetic books use the word chesed in the sense of practicing beneficence toward one who has, I assume, has no right at all to claim this from you. Therefore, every benefit that comes from him, and may he be exalted, is called chesed. Thus it says, the world is built up in chesed.
So this, the Hebrew there is Olam Chesed Yibaneh. It's a rabbi creditor song. Before rabbi creditor sang it, it was first in Tehillim, in Psalms. So Olam Chesed Yibaneh, the world is built up in chesed. How does he define it?
The meaning of which is, the building up of the world is chesed. And he, may he be exalted, says in an enumeration of his attributes, and abundant in chesed.
Okay, so let's just break down those two, like explain those verses. So the way that the Rambam translates David's Psalms, Olam Chesed Yibaneh, where the world is built up in chesed, is that the building of the world, the creation of a world, is the original and maybe the primary act of chesed. Chesed is what the Kabbalists, it's interesting here how the Rambam is very similar in his definition of chesed to the Kabbalists, because normally they're on opposite ends of the aisle. They don't often reach across the aisle, to put it in contemporary terms. But here, the Kabbalists refer to chesed as shefa, as just a flow of divine energy, into bringing something into existence that wasn't there prior to it. God created the world, according to the Kabbalists, through the name of the divine name of Chesed, which is the Tetragrammaton, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, as opposed to the name Elohim, which is God's name of judgment, of withholding. So Chesed is giving forth. Din, judgment, is holding back. And creation of anything is an act of Chesed. Right? There's something to this, like creative types, people who really kind of make something that was not there before. The way that the Kabbalists and the Rambam defines that, that is an act of chesed, of giving forth something that was not there. And similarly, the second source, just to locate this in where in the Torah, is in the 13 attributes of mercy, where God forgives the Jewish people after the sin of the golden calf and gives Moshe a key. This is what you should say in the future when you guys mess up, because it's going to happen. It's going to be inevitable part of the Jewish people, because we're going to make mistakes, and hopefully we'll atone for them. So we say, Hashem, Hashem, kel rachem v'chanun, God, the Lord who is merciful and rachem v'chanun, kind and merciful. Let's go with that. Hashem, Hashem, kel rachem v'chanun, erech apayim, slow to anger, v'rav chesed, and abundant, large in kindness. So what does that mean? So the way that the Rama translates that is God is the creator of something that was not there before. That's how he defines Rav Chesed, being created in kindness. God can create at a scale that no one else can create in. That's what makes God, God. And when you think about it in this, going back to what we started with, if your definition of Chesed is either the creation or the bestowal of something that was not there before, right, then the opening chapters of Bereishit is the ultimate act of chesed, right? God creating a world that certainly, according to Maimonides, he did not need, right? This is where the Maimonidean tradition and the Kabbalist tradition are going to veer off from each other. But for the Kabbalists, God had some need of to be recognized by other. And so God creates a world in which there are human beings that are in need of God, and it's kind of this reciprocal relationship. But for Maimonides, in the rationalist tradition, God doesn't need anything. God's decision to create the world is the ultimate act of kindness and benevolence, of just the desire to give to another for their own goodness. And the entire at the entire purpose of creating the world is just to bestow good upon the other, which I think is a beautiful interpretation. So now, where does a human obligation to do chesed come from?
So, to be like God.
To be like God, right? So that's.
So if God is giving, then that would teach us. If we want to.
Yeah.
Try to emulate God, then we should create as well.
Right, we should create and give to other, give to the other, just like God gives to the other, right? Just like God creates a world for the benefit of those in the world. Right, so too we can give to others for their benefit with a sense of selflessness. That is imitatio Dei, right? Imitating God, being godlike. And this is something that the famous Gemara discusses this. This is, by the way, a foil, because the theory that I'm going to present tonight that I never really thought of before, that there's actually two forms of chesed. There's two forms of kindness. But let's start with this one, and then we'll go to a second that Maimonides introduces, which I think is a fascinating approach. So this is the Talmud in source 4. Source 3 is good too, but read it in your own time. This is source 4, back on the first page, is in the Gemara in Masechet Sota, and it's based on a question of how to define a verse in Devarim. And you have multiple verses that say something similar, which is "Acharei Hashem Elokeichem Telechu," walk after God. You should walk literally in God's path. And the obvious question that the Gemara asks is, this is the fourth line in the English, right? How on earth can I do that, right? How could someone walk in God's path? Here the Gemara phrases it as a technical problem, right? God is a consuming fire. You can't walk behind a fire and not get burned. Right. Is this literal? Is this allegorical? Right. I think for most of us, we're going to interpret we don't believe God to have any physical presence. So, but that even enlarges the question. If God has no physical presence, how do you literally walk in God's path? And so here's to Kirsten's point. Right. The Gemara now goes through multiple examples of how God acts in the world. Mm-hmm. And it says if you want to walk after God, you don't physically walk. Right. You don't physically walk. You do like God. And so examples of this are Mahu, just as God clothes the naked. And you'll see here, this is the example that we started with. This is the first thing God does after the creation of the world, right? Just as God clothes the naked in Genesis, right? Hashem made clothing for Adam and Chava. So too, you should clothe the naked, right? Just as God visits the sick. The example, where do we see God visiting the sick in our tradition?
Abraham.
Great. After Abraham, after the Brit Milah of Abraham, God sends Anashim, I think the language is men, but our tradition says they're angels, right? So it's either God, no, sorry, it's not even the angels. The opening verse in chapter 18 is that God appeared to Avram Be'alonei Mamre, right after his circumcision. So God, what was God doing there? Bikur Cholim, visiting the sick. If you want to be like God, if you want to walk in God's ways, what should you do too? You should also visit the sick. God consoles mourners, right? Nichum Avilim. So where does that happen? It says that God blessed Yitzchak after his father's death. Yes, that's a form of comforting mourners. So too, you should comfort mourners. And then finally, the last moments of the Torah, just as God buries the dead, God buried Moshe and no one else, so too you should bury the dead. I think it's beautiful about this source is that walking in God's path or following God doesn't have an end destination to it, right? It's like a constant life journey of finding opportunities to be like God, right? There's no destination in this walk, right? It's the journey itself that matters. Another permutation of this that I mentioned earlier, and one nice reason to bring it up is it's this week's Parsha, is the Song of the Sea. At the Song of the Sea, God has just taken us through the Sea of Reeds. You could say that that's probably, you know, in our tradition in the Gemara, and then you see this very clearly in the Haggadah as well, right? The splitting of the sea is a much larger miracle than even the plagues of Egypt, right? It's lots and lots of miracles, a huge scale of miracles from God. That's an act of chesed, right? God has taken us out of bondage. God has done us a great kindness as a nation. And what do we do after? So we try to thank God for that kindness. So the opening words of the Song of the Sea are Zekhili Vanvehu. This is source 5. You can read for yourselves. Oziva Zimratka, my strength and my might is God. By Hilu Lishua, he will be for me a salvation. Ze Eliv Anvehu, Elohe Aviv Ramamenhu. This is my God, and I will. Here the translation is, I will enshrine him, the God of my father, and I will raise him up. I will exalt him. Ram is to make. Ram is high. Ramamenhu means I will lift him up high. Okay, but that's an easier word to translate. Anvehu is a very difficult word to translate. So what does Anvehu mean? The word enshrine here is like the translator's best guess. The Talmud has two answers.
What's the shorash?
That's the problem. It's hard to find the shorash. It's hard to find the root. One possibility about the root here is that Naveh, which you see elsewhere in Tanakh, you see it in the Song of the Songs, where the male lover tells the female lover, Ki kolech arev ve marech naveh, because your voice is pleasant and your appearance is naveh, is beautiful. So the word naveh somehow connects to the idea of beauty. And the Talmud says, how can you be like God? How can you make God naveh? You can't make God beautiful. It's like you're not going to put makeup on God, right? You're not going to dress God up. So what do you do? Mm-hmm. The Gemara's first answer is, make God beautiful by beautifying the commandments. So this is the principle, the biblical principle of hidur mitzvah, of taking mitzvot and making them more beautiful. So get a nice kiddush cup, beautiful Shabbat candles, right? Nice tefillin, nice mezuzot. All of that falls under the mitzvah of hidur mitzvah. That's possibly rooted in this word here. I will glorify God means I will make the mitzvot beautiful in an attempt to kind of give back to God in some way. That's answer number one. Answer number two is that the word anvehu is a combination of two words. Anvehu is ani vehu, I and him. That there's this dual relationship. And how does one do this? So this is exactly what Kirsten said. And this is, if there's a quote line that you want, if you want to sound fancy and you know a lot about chesed in the tradition, from the Gemara itself, this is the Gemara you should quote. It's source 6 in Shabbat. Mahu chanun v'rachum af ata heye chanun v'rachum. Just as God is merciful and kind, so too you should be merciful and kind. Right? It's a shortened version of the Gemara that we saw before. Right? Ani v'hu. I will be just as he is. Right? So that's how I'm going to glorify God. By being like God, by being kind to others. Okay. Beautiful. That's source number one. Where does the origin or the obligation of kindness come from? It comes from some form of either walking behind God or being like God, right? Being anivahu, kind of trying to make myself just as the way I perceive God to act in the world. The Rambam, though, roots it in something far simpler. Where does the Rambam root this mitzvah in? So what is the great principle of the Torah? According to Pirkei Avot, what is the one most simple principle in the Torah? Great. Right? Ve'ahavta li'racha kamocha. Love your fellow as you love. Well, it's not the greatest translation on earth. Ve'ahavta, you should love. Li'racha, your fellow, your friend, kamocha, as you love yourself. Okay. The Rambam, if you look in the Laws of the Morning, source 8, goes through a whole long list. Once he's finished talking about the details of mourning and how to comfort mourners. Let's read source 8. I think this is an important one. Joan, can you read it for us?
It is a positive commandment of rabbinic origin to visit sick, comfort mourners, to prepare for a funeral, prepare a bride, accompany guests, attend to all the needs of burial, carry a corpse on one's shoulders, walk before the God bear.
It's like it's the funeral procession.
Mourn, dig the grave, and bury the dead, and also to bring joy to the bride and groom and help them in all their needs. These are deeds of kindness that one carries out with his person that have no limit. Although all these mitzvot are rabbinic origin, they are included in the scriptural commandment Leviticus, love your neighbor as yourself. That change implies that whatever you would like other people, that charge, sorry, implies that whatever you would like other people to do for you, you should do for your comrade in the Torah and mitzvot.
Okay. So, it's a good one, right?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit of a
distraction, but...
Okay. So then can I ask you a favor? Can I just finish up this section and then get to the question? Is that all right?
Okay.
Remind me, though, because I want to hear the question and hopefully do my best to answer it. I had never thought about... Well, actually, I had thought about this, right? You seem to have these two different forms or origins for chesed, for doing good unto others, right? There's the Rambam's form of do to others like you want to be done to you, right? And then there's this much more like ethereal of like walk with God kind of origin to the mitzvah. And I think that's really significant and intentional. We're not going to deal with the fact that the Rambam says that this is a rabbinic commandment for now. I'll say that for another time. And here's the way that Rabbi Daniel Feldman formulated it. And I think it was really beautiful. That within our tradition, we have two forms of chesed. There is kind of the basic human sense of ethics and morality. And then there is this higher form of being godlike, right? And they're actually different. They're really different from each other, right? The basic human morality requires us exactly what the commandment says, right? Do unto others as you want to unto yourself. There's a famous story of Hillel who has an interpretation of V'ahavta re'echa kamocha. Right? If you want to read it for yourselves later, it's verse 9, of someone coming to Hillel, to Shammai first, and saying, would you convert me if I stand... Teach me the Torah while I stand on one foot, and Shammai kicks them out. And then goes the same prospective convert comes to Hillel, and Hillel says, and the words here are important, right? De alach sani lechavercha lo tavid. That which is hateful to you, don't do to your friend, right? And then says the rest is commentary. Go and study, right? Idach perusha. The rest is just all the stuff that is commentary on this. Now go and learn. And it's unclear if he converts him at the beginning or at the end of that learning. But okay, that formulation of it makes it really clear that possibly the mitzvah for the Rambam of chesed is not being a jerk to other people, right? Is that kind of underlying, don't do bad things to other people that you would hope they don't do to you. That's,
so is that an overt action? I mean, or as opposed to your internal
focus? So, right, how do you define that? The way I think the Rambam defines it, which is so interesting, is that, like, in biblical origin, it wasn't defined. And then the rabbis said, here's this list of things that you should do that fall under, like, the basic categories of being a mensch, being a nice person, of v'ahavta re'echa kamocha, right? Dancing before bride and groom, right? Accompanying the deceased in their funeral procession, right? That these are, like, basic components of human dignity, right? That the rabbis expanded it. But it sounds like as a biblical principle, before the rabbis gave these extensions to it, it was very much like your own internal moral compass that would require that. And that's a baseline of chesed, right? And then there's the higher level, right? There's the imitatio Dei, there's the being like God, walking in God's ways, right? That is a much higher level. How high is that? How far does that require you to go? Part two. Okay, we'll get there in a second. Yeah, Kirsten, your question.
So, maybe because I'm very much of a literalist.
Yes.
It says, carry a corpse on one shoulder.
Okay.
Yeah. So, was there any... I mean, it sounds like there wasn't a coffin. Did it ever come to pass that people carried...
Yeah.
...a dead person?
It's still done without a coffin in Israel.
I don't know.
It's a great question.
Have you ever been in Israel?
Yeah, I don't know. So the opposite question is one that I don't have the answer to. I don't know where and when coffins began as a Jewish practice. I imagine it happened. I think in Muslim countries it still doesn't happen either. I mean, mm-hmm.
They don't put people in coffins.
Right.
They still do it in the synagogue.
Okay.
In
shrouds of some sort.
Yeah,
so I think that's still the practice in Israel. So historically, I don't know where and when the custom to bury in a coffin happened. It was very clear that the coffin has to be as minimalist as possible. Right? That's definitely within our tradition of it can't be a metal coffin, it has to be able to decompose, etc. So that's all going back to the original practice of...
So right. He's actually talking about putting a shroud and then carrying...
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That's
a great question. So now that we've kind of broken chesed down into two pieces, right, that there's kind of the baseline human dignity of, you know, if you wouldn't like someone doing that to you, right, you shouldn't do it to others. Maybe the original deraita in Ve'ahavta l'rech kamocha, love your fellows yourself, is in the things you're not allowed to do to others. And maybe that's a formulation of the negative, and the positive is the formulation of walking in God's ways. The things you do for others, maybe those are the positive commandments, and maybe that's how you divide out these two origins to chesed, that is two roots of kindness. But what is the limit of kindness? And so there's a Mishnah in Peah that we read a form of this, a version of this, every morning after the blessings of the Torah. And I'll go through it quickly. This is source 11. Here, so I'll give you the next one to read. Eilud varim she'em lehem shi'ur. These are the mitzvot that have no shi'ur. A shi'ur is a defined quantity. Not like a class, but like a divine quantity. And what are they? So you can go through them yourself. Peah is the corner of a field. When you have a farm and you're harvesting your farm, you have to leave a corner of it for the poor. There's three of those mitzvot. Peah, shechata, veleket. Bikurim, first fruits. Right? There's no defined amount, but so we'll have to see what that actually means. Reayon, that's the offerings you bring when you first see the temple. There's a special korban for the first time you see the Beit HaMikdash. You have to eat something in Jerusalem. Gemilut chasadim, right? Acts of kindness. There's no shi'or, there's no defined quantity for how much chesed you should do. Talmud Torah and Torah study. Okay. The next phrase here, this is, we have a slightly different version from the Tosefta that we say in the morning prayers right after the blessings in the Torah. These are the things that a person eats their fruits in this world, but the Keren Kayemet, the principle, remains for the world to come. Basically, this is the Talmud's or the Mishnah's investment strategy, right? There are certain mitzvot that give off interest, and the reward, like the interest, is the reward you enjoy in this world, the schar you get in this world, but the actual principle that you've earned for yourself stays for the world to come. And if you look at that list, right, there's other things: honoring one's parents, milut chasadim, kindness, havat shalom bina adam l'chaviro, bringing peace between two people, v'talmud Torah k'neged kulam, and Torah study. And how you define those last two words is really important. Torah study is opposite them all. K'neged, right? K'neged means facing against. So I'm trying to be as literal as possible in my translation here. The translation here that I think came from Sepharia is Torah study is equal to them all. So that's how it's commonly translated. So what does that mean? Does that mean that Torah study is equal in weight to every one of those individual mitzvot? Or imagine you have a scale, right? And you want to balance your scale out. So you put Torah study on one side and every other mitzvah on the other, and then they balance.
Or it's a mirror.
Right. Or it's a mirror. Can you explain that image to me?
If you translate it in English, it's facing against it.
Yeah.
So it's reflection.
It's a reflection of the others. Like, you can find all the others within Torah study. Is that what you meant by it?
These acts are reflections of the Torah.
Hmm. They're reflections of the Torah. Yeah.
Perhaps they're reflections of how much Torah study you have actually gotten inside yourself.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the words are something you live rather than just words you mumble.
That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. The question that I'm going to lead towards is, what happens if you have to decide between Torah study and Kamila Chasadim?
Right.
What happens if you have limited time, you have half an hour, and you can either go volunteer in a soup kitchen or you can go and study Torah?
Right.
What's your obligation? So some of that's going to have to depend on how you translate those last two words. If they're equal, then maybe
either one.
15 minutes of each?
I guess.
Is it how do you prioritize? How do you prioritize one or the other?
Then you can do one.
Right.
And it's the same as you do the other.
Okay.
Right.
Great. So before we get to that even more important and complicated question, which we're not going to do full justice to tonight, how do you define it? These are the things that have no shi'or, that have no defined amount? And for now, we're going to focus on kamilut chasadim, doing kindness. So there's two ways to read this, right? If it has no defined amount, it could mean that the most minute action, right, of kindness fulfills your obligation. So once upon a time, I was walking down the road and someone was limping, so I stepped out of their way and they kept walking and I didn't get in the way, and I've now fulfilled my obligation of Gemilut Chasidim.
I think it's more about, like, there's no quantity. I mean, it's something that, like, you, because there is no limit, that it is, you are continuing to add to the pile of chesed, right? There's,
right. So you're saying that no matter how much chesed one does in their life, they have never maxed out their shiur,
right?
So as an example, we know, you can quantify a lot of mitzvot, right? To give a corollary, I mean, we have this idea of giving maaser, giving a tenth of your earnings without going into details to tzedakah, right? That's a quantifiable mitzvah on some level. Right? You know when you get to your 10% if you keep track and have a budget, etc. Another example, right? There's a mitzvah to light Shabbat candles, right? You either lit them or you didn't. Right? You either fulfilled the obligation or the mitzvah or you didn't fulfill the mitzvah. Putting on tefillin is a similar example. So you could wear tefillin all day long in theory, but either you did it or you didn't, right? And maybe the reading of Ein LaShiur, right? These things have no requisite amount, no defined amount, is that you can keep doing it and doing it and doing it, but you've never really you've never finished your obligation, right? And we'll get back to that at the end. So that actually is a machloket. It's a debate in the commentaries of how to read this, right? Either it means Ein LaShiur, there's no lower limit, right? So no matter how little you did, succeeds in fulfilling the mitzvah, or, right, there's no upper limit, and you could keep doing kindness your entire life and still not have finished your obligation. You're still not done. There's still more opportunities to do. Many people think of Torah study the same way, and that comes from this, right? Because Torah study is in this list as well. It also has no end. Most people...
kind of like,
yeah,
Rabbi Akiva, who famously said, as he was being burned to death, I always wondered how you could, with all your soul, love.
Yeah,
and
I love God.
So that he too found that only as he was dying did he reach the penultimate.
Yeah, the loving God with all your soul, even when God takes away your soul. Yeah.
Right, so that's right. Kind of giving a little weight to the argument that there's no upper limit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And that's beautiful, yeah. So let's now kind of take that, Allison, you have a, yeah.
Going back to your question about Torah versus doing an act of kindness, what I'm wondering is whether doing an act of kindness is a mitzvah and Torah study is a mitzvah, but the mitzvot are also in the Torah, so by doing, I'm not being articulate here, but
yeah,
by doing a mitzvah, aren't you also doing Torah, and therefore the scale goes that way?
Yeah. There are actually different rabbis in the Talmud who said opposite things about this. Mm-hmm. There's a machloket about what's greater, right? The lo halimuta ikar alamasa. There's one opinion that the study is less important than the actions based on the study. That the whole point of studying Torah is that eventually you should learn to practice the Torah. That's one school of thought. There's another school of thought in the Gemara also originally. You know, the learning itself is the primary thing. You have examples of that within our tradition of mitzvot, either positive or negative, that may have never happened. An example of this is the mitzvah of Ben Sora Umore, the rebellious son. So there's this
one
mitzvah.
One of my favorites.
Right, I think it's the gluttonous rebellious son, right? Ben Sora Umore. Very hard to translate what those words mean. And the Talmud gives a list of the definitions that it's someone who's between 13 and 13 and a half and has stolen meat from the market and wine from the market. And the halacha in the Torah itself is that this boy, this young man, should be stoned to death. And the Talmud's explanation is they've basically shown now that they're on their path towards eventually murdering another person. Better that they should die innocent of that stricter crime than die guilty of it and having taken someone else's life. And the Talmud is so disturbed by that one of the rabbis says, lo haya velo yia, there has never, ever been someone who met all the requisite requirements in the Gemara to qualify as this rebellious son. And so why was the mitzvah given? So the Gemara's answer is drosh v'kabel schar. The Torah gave this mitzvah so that you should study it, expound it, and receive reward for its study. So maybe there's a case to be made that study is the most important part. Okay? So even if you shouldn't practice, maybe some of these mitzvot aren't meant to be practiced, they're just meant to be studied. Here's a few kind of real life difficulties. What if someone asks you for a favor, or you're inclined to do someone a favor, but you would have to sacrifice $100 to do it? Right? Are you obligated? Let's talk in the sphere of obligation. Right? Are you obligated to give up your own money to do something good for someone else? Okay, that's one. Second example, what if there's something that you could do, but it's not pleasant for you to do it? It's beneath your dignity. What if, I don't know, someone dropped their wallet into the sewer and, like, there were feces there, right? I don't know. Would you be obligated to embarrass yourself, right, to retrieve the wallet? Maybe nowadays it might be a smartphone, right?
I was going to say it was a smartphone. Go on.
Definitely. Okay. And a third is, what if you could do something that wouldn't be embarrassing necessarily and wouldn't be a financial loss, but would be exceedingly difficult, right? What if someone asks you, I think every once in a while, definitely for people who aren't great at setting boundaries and limits, you get these kinds of questions of, like, someone asking you a favor, like, oh, would you mind, you know, at 3 p.m. during a workday driving, you know, across town? Often I think the people who tend to ask for those favors are not willing to always do things for themselves, which is my inclination, but maybe I'm just not good at setting boundaries. Or what if there's something that would be exceedingly difficult for you? How do you evaluate whether you should do that act of kindness for someone else versus not do it at all? So I think these are like different, these are the conflicts of real life.
Absolutely.
Right? And how do you evaluate those conflicts? So this is a tough one to, you know, in halachic discussions, we normally try to find precedent, halachic precedent from within our tradition. It's really hard to find, like, nowhere does the Torah, there are actually a few examples, and the Gemara Megillah talks about when are you obligated to interrupt your Torah study to go to a funeral and comfort mourners. So there is a discussion there that's framed more along the lines of how many people are already there mourning. What Rabbi Daniel Feldman in his book kind of pointed out is that one of the best precedents, because it's hard to find precedent for when, how to evaluate chesed, can't really do it from charity, because charity is an obligation that has a fixed amount to it. And most of the other mitzvot have fixed amounts. He said that the best precedent to find is the mitzvah hashavat aveda, the mitzvah to, or the obligation to return lost objects. Return the lost objects.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of an interesting parallel, because that is a specified mitzvah in the Torah. V'hashevot halo, there's a biblical obligation, you shall surely return a lost object to your fellow. This is going about, like, if you find an ox in the middle of the road or a donkey in the middle of the road, you have to take it on and then give it to the person. Even if it's your enemy, you still are obligated to return it to them. But the Talmud goes into the nitty-gritty of, like, well, one sec, maybe there are exceptions to this rule. Right? Maybe this rule is not all-encompassing. And I think it's worth, we're going to finish soon, but I think it's worth spending a few minutes reading through some of these exceptions in the Talmud in Bava Metzia, 30a and b. This is verse 12. Kirsten, would you like to start the first half of the source for us?
Okay, right here.
Source 12.
What?
Yeah, third page.
The Mishnah teaches, person found a sack or a basket or any other item that is not his typical manner to take and carry because it's beneath his dignity, he shall not take it. The Gemara asks, from where are these matters derived? It is, as the sages taught Nagarita, it is stated with regard to the return of a lost item, you shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep wandering and disregard them. You shall return them to your brother. The Tana explains that the phrase, and disregard them, means that there are occasions in which you may disregard lost items, and there are occasions in which you may not disregard them.
Okay, so I'll just pause there to kind of elaborate on the exposition going on here in the Talmud. The exposition here in the Talmud is based on how do you punctuate that verse, right? Do you punctuate the verse as, right, you're not allowed to see your fellow's ox wandering, right, comma, vehitalamta, and sometimes you can disregard them? Or is you can disregard them part of the original negative, right, negative prohibition? So depending on whether you put a comma in your reading before vehitalamta, before and you disregard them, right, either you disregard them as part of the negative prohibition, you're not allowed to disregard them, or it's their ox and their sheep you can't see and let go, comma, but sometimes you can disregard them. And based on these two alternate readings of the text, right, the Gemara now wants to find the circumstances in which you're allowed to disregard the mitzvah of returning lost objects, right? And sometimes, and when are you obligated to return the lost objects? So that's where the exposition is coming out here, where the drasha is coming out here. Just to make sure that we go along, get around in our volunteers and make you all do some of the hard reading work. Don, would you mind reading from How So?
No. How So, under what circumstances may one disregard a lost item? One may do so in a case where he was a priest and the lost item is in the graveyard, or where he was an elderly person and is not in keeping with his dignity to tend to the item, or where the value of his labor was greater than the value of the lost item of the other person, i.e. if the finder was to return the item, reimbursing him for his lost wages would cost more than the value of the item. Therefore, it is stated, and disregard them.
Okay. So...
what's the priest losing in the graveyard?
So, that's an interesting one, right?
A body?
So, no. Right, great question. So, the priest in the graveyard... So, a Kohen is not allowed to make himself...
Right.
Ritually impure, and standing above a grave would make one ritually impure. So imagine that you are walking down the road and you see like a diamond ring on top of a grave, and you want to claim it and bring it to the city center and make it a big announcement. You know, if anyone lost a ring, please come find, pick your Cohen, right? Please find like Abe Cohen, right? And they can return it to you. So the Gemara actually brings that up as a question, like, this was an obvious one, right? We have a general principle that positive commandments cannot overweigh some other commandments. To get a little bit technical here, becoming ritually impure as a Kohen has a positive and a negative mitzvah. There's the mitzvah to be pure, and then there's also a negative commandment not to become impure. And so the Gemara says that's assumed. Nowhere would you assume that one positive commandment, returning lost objects, would override a positive and a negative commandment, which is remaining pure and not becoming impure. And so then the Gemara at the end, here, Joel, I'll make you skip down to the last paragraph on this page. Joel, can you read from Gemara suggests? Yeah.
From rather?
Yeah.
The Gemara suggests rather say that the verse is necessary to derive the exemption from returning the lost item in the case where the value of his labor was greater than the value of the lost item of the other. The Gemara rejects that possibility. The halakha is derived not from the phrase and disregard them, but from that which Rav Yehuda says that the Rav says, it is written, only so that there shall be no needy among you. This verse can be understood as a command, indicating that it is incumbent upon each individual to ensure that he will not become needy. Therefore, your assets take precedence over the assets of any other person.
Okay. So that's a little technical here. The end result of this Gemara is that we basically agree on a few circumstances in which someone is exempt from returning lost objects. The complicated part here is where you derive it from, what verse you derive it from. What's fascinating is that there's this verse in Devarim chapter 15. That's the verse read on the end of that third page, right? Efes ki lo yevecha evyon, that it is like only that there may not be among you a poor person. Generally, this is an obligation to support the poor. But the drash here, the final exposition is, there should not be b'cha, with you, a poor person. And the Gemara Darshan expounds from this, right, that sorry, Shelcha Kodem Lashel Kol Adam, that your property, your money, can come before someone else's money. So we now see that in the laws of returning lost objects, you have a few exceptions. Strictly speaking, the letter of the law is, if it's a prohibition for you to return it, you can't transgress a mitzvah to do it. You are not obligated to do it, and then we'll have to see what does not obligated mean. If you would have to pay money to do it, right? If it's right, then the interesting one, one that I think is really, you know, has to be evaluated on a case by case basis, is if it's more work for you, right, than the benefit it would bring someone else. Isn't it like such a? It's such a intuitive approach, right?
I think it's, you can just hang with Hillel. Don't do to somebody else what you wouldn't want them to do for you. So if you want somebody to do, if you would want somebody to do you a favor,
mm-hmm.
to drive you in the middle of rush hour to someplace better, if they ask you, you'd best be prepared to say yes. Otherwise, you have no right to ever ask that.
So if you're willing to ask someone else for a favor, you have to be willing to
say yes
when someone else asks you to do the same favor. Yeah, I think that's a good... Yeah. This is a good example where there's a subjectivity to it.
Right.
Right? Each person is going to define their threshold.
Seems to be what Hillel was teaching.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Here, it's interesting that the Gemara derives it out of this idea that you don't have to put yourself out... That you're not obligated to put yourself out more than someone else... would be obligated to, more than the other person would be willing to lose. I think what you're saying is makes sense, and I agree with that, and I think that would be the halachic approach. I would just say here that, as an example, if the kindness you would do for someone else, let's say you want to give someone a ride to work so that they can get there an hour early, and if they get there an hour early, they get an extra hour of wages, right? There's room to say, I'm going to evaluate this person's wage is, let's say, $20 an hour, but it's actually going to cost me going out of my way, let's say it's an extra hour in my daily trip. If I make $25 an hour, right, then I wouldn't be obligated to go out of my way to help them earn the 20 because then I'd be losing 25.
You have to hire a babysitter to go take somebody an hour early.
Yeah.
Right? And you're out. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. The
hardship. Right. The hardship argument. And this is codified in the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, which is a fascinating book in its own right. The history of this book is that the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, was basically getting flack for the fact that no one thought the Hasidim kept halacha. They were perceived as this like radical antinomian movement. They were kind of perceived as like the reform
movement. Radical
antinomian, like antinomian. Oppositional, like crazy person movement. Basically, that they were doing voodoo, let's say, out of the box stuff.
Okay.
And the Baal Shem Tov was convinced that the only way to redeem the Hasidic movement in the eyes of the non-Hasidim was to prove to them that they adhered to halacha just as carefully, if not better, than everyone else. And so he told his most intellectual, halachically minded student, the founder of the Lubavitch movement, the Baal HaTanya, to write a Shulchan Aruch for Hasidim, to write a code of Jewish law that would codify the Hasidic interpretation of Jewish law. And that's the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. I'm going to summarize it. He takes the ideas we just saw in the Gemara and says that you're also obligated, this is actually quoting from a separate Gemara, that you're obligated to save another person from a loss. We didn't see that so far, right? The Gemara that he quotes here is that if you see someone's field being inundated with water and you can divert that water from flooding their field, you're obligated to stop the flooding. He says if you see damage to their property that you can stop, you're obligated to stop the damage to their property. Then he goes and gives an exception. He says, however, if you'd have to spend money to do this, and he says specifically if you're a business owner and you'd have to basically give up on earnings to do that favor and stop the other person's field from being flooded, he says you're not obligated to do it. He says the strict halakha is you're not obligated to give up your own, to lose money or to give up potential earnings to save another person from damage or to return a lost object to them. He defines it as
so
the same thing.
Flood is encompassing your property and the neighbor's property. your obligation is to yourself first? Is that
yes.
The same thing?
Yeah. Well, he doesn't say it explicitly, but that's the idea that we read in the ends of the last Gemara, right? That shelcha kodem shelcha adam, that your monetary, you're allowed to save your money before someone, your property before someone else's property. So he says that meikaradin, the halacha dictates that you are exempt. And then he goes on and says, and I'm going to summarize it in my own words, that if you are a person who is always looking for the exemption, right? If you're always looking for, like, you're finagling, you're finding,
yeah.
He says, if you're always medaktik, diktuk is when you're, like, grammar, but it's when you're being very careful, you're reading very carefully and trying to find a way out. If that's your personality, he does not have nice words for you. He says that basically you have just given up. You've been porek ol. You've lifted off the yoke of chesed, which is the foundation of who we are as people, right? And he says that this is why the halacha has a concept built into it, that there is the din, there's the law, and then there's lifnim mishur din, there's going beyond the letter of the law. And he says a person who's always just exacting on the law to get out of their obligations to other people and never trains themselves to go above the letter of the law, that person's really not a person. They're not living their potential in life, right? Because I think this goes back to the first part. If you just think of your obligations as v'haftol reach kamocha, right? Just what I want for myself, I'll do that to other people. So I wouldn't necessarily want someone else to lose out on their daily wages, right? So therefore, I'm not obligated to lose out on my daily wages for them, right? That kind of relationship. That's the baseline. But then there's the being like God, right? And if you're someone who only just sticks at the letter of the law, right? Well, God is, I'm going to say this and hopefully won't regret it one day if it's recorded, right? God is larger than halacha, right? God is more than just the letter of the law, right? That's how God acts, right? When God clothed Abraham, he wasn't obligated to, right? The fact that we exist on earth and God does kindness for us, he didn't have to do that for us, right? And so part of chesed is doing the things that you don't have to do. We're not going to get into the debate of Torah versus chesed, just for the sake of time. I'll just tell you that in this large discussion, the Netziv says that these two mitzvot are both Ein Lam Shiur. Neither of them have any end. They're both eternal mitzvot. And so how do you decide which one to prioritize? He says, think about what your personality is. Are you an intellectual or are you a doer? He says, follow your intuition. It's an amazing thing to say. Rav Moshe Feinstein had a famous responso where he said even great scholars, he recommended that they give maser, that they give their time. They give a tenth of their time. They take away a tenth of their time from Torah study and give it towards basically volunteering, chesed. Maybe that means you're studying with someone who needs some help in their studies. But that's a beautiful application that even a Torah scholar who's probably not making the big bucks has to give a tenth of their time to help others. And I'll just add a qualification in general that it's clear from a number of sources that when it comes to prioritizing kindness, that family members, being kind to family members is also a form of kindness and is often the largest form of kindness. There are definitely people, I remember an expression from the head of the yeshiva I went to where he said, don't make your family the altar. Don't make your children the altar upon which you slaughter like the sacrifices of your family. Basically, I'm forgetting the exact expression. It's basically saying, like, don't convince yourself that just because you as a rabbi are taking care of the whole community that you're allowed to sacrifice for your family. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. Like, spending time with siblings and children and parents, that's also chesed. And in some ways, it's the more important chesed, right? And we'll end with the expression from Rabbi Tarfon in the Pirkei Avot that I think is a beautiful definition of this boundless mitzvah, which is lo alecha hamlacha ligmar, right? It's not expected for you to finish the work, right? Velo ata ben chorin liba tal mimena. Neither are you free to exempt yourself from it, right? Even if you could, on the technical letter of the law, find ways to be exempt all the time, right? Then you're missing the point of what it means to do chesed, because chesed's not just about the basic human morality. It's also to strive to be like God. And that requires going above and beyond the letter of the law, even knowing that as we follow God, we're never going to get all the way there. But we still have to keep trying. Thanks.
Thank you.